Muslims around the world hold mourning ceremonies to mark Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. At least three people are killed and 50 others wounded when a bomb rips through a procession marking Ashura in central Pakistan. The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says that the tanker will sail from Iran to bring desperately needed fuel supplies to Lebanon. Tens of thousands of Muslims have converged on the holy Iraqi city of Karbala to commemorate Ashura. That's the day that marks the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Karbala is the resting place of Imam Hussein. Ceremonies in the city are the centerpiece of those held across the globe. Ashura marks the climax of the annual event held in the first 10 days of the lunar month of Muharram. Muslims across the world show their grief for the sufferings of the Imam and his companions by holding processions and congregations. Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD. People all over Iran have also commemorated Ashura by holding mourning ceremonies while observing health protocols. A short time ago, our correspondent Saeed Burza joined us from London to tell us about the processions held in the British capital to mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein.
Here in London, we're in Hyde Park, where thousands of people have gathered. If we were to look in both directions, different processions, one moving in that direction and another one in this. And they've been here commemorating the martyrdom of the third Shiite Imam, Imam Hussein, over the past few hours. The man who really made the ultimate sacrifice, along with 72 of his companions and his family members, all those years ago, to stand up to corruption and injustice. What we've been looking at, really, people clad in black beating their chests and shedding tears over what he and his companions did back into the 7th century. The crowd really has been here for hours now. They are now moving towards another location called Holland Park, which will probably get another hour. London being really home to a thriving community of Shias, where every household, Shia household you look at, people putting up banners, black banners like they do in other parts of the world, people who've gathered here of different, really, nationalities.
At least three people have been killed and some 50 others wounded in a bomb attack in Pakistan's eastern province of Punjab. The incident occurred when a powerful roadside bomb targeted the mourning procession of Shiite Muslims. Women and children were among the injured. Videos circulating on social media show police cars and ambulances rushing to the scene of the explosion. Several wounded people are also seen waiting for help along the road. The leader of Yemen's Ansar movement says that his people have every right to boost their capabilities against aggressors. Abdul Malik al-Houthi made a comment during his speech on the occasion of Ashura that marks the martyrdom anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson. The leader of the Ansar movement also said that the schemes of the U.S. and its allies will ultimately fail. He said the U.S. Pullout from Afghanistan shows the failure of occupation forces in the region. Houthi said that the movement will continue to support the Palestinian cause until the end of the Israeli occupation. He stressed the Yemeni movement will continue with resistance against the aggressors until they gain victory. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that the presence of American forces in the region aims to revive the Daesh terrorist group.
Hukuma The governments in the region and the resistance groups are enough to eradicate Daesh, and there is no need for the US assistance. There is evidence that American forces in the region are actually facilitating the revival of the terrorist group.
Nasrallah says Washington's claim of fighting Daesh in Syria is a lie, calling for American withdrawal from the Arab country. He said the U.S. failure in Afghanistan has made it clear that regional states should not pin their hopes on the U.S., which he said intends to keep its hegemonic grip on the West Asia region and resources. The Hezbollah chief also described the Iraqi government's decision to expel U.S. troops as a significant achievement, saying it's the result of sacrifices made by resistance groups. He also urged all Muslims to stand by Palestinians and their resistance against oppression and occupation. He said that the resistance movement is ready to defend the Lebanese sovereignty.
On this Ashura Day, we want to make it clear to our enemies and friends that any development inside Lebanon or the region would not impact their strength, readiness, and steadfastness of the resistance movement. We have enough human resources and capabilities to face occupying powers and defend Lebanon's sovereignty.
Nasrallah said that the United States is waging an economic war and a media campaign against Lebanon to serve the interests of the Tel Aviv regime. Regarding the country's political crisis, he rejected allegations that Hezbollah was hampering efforts for the formation of a new government. On the fuel crisis, Nasrallah said that Hezbollah has organized a shipment of fuel from Iran in order to alleviate the shortage. The head of the Lebanese resistance movement warned the U.S. and Israel against any move to halt the delivery. He stressed that Hezbollah considers the fuel-carrying boat as Lebanese territory. Sources close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council say the shipment was purchased by a group of Lebanese merchants and is their property from the moment of loading. The Lebanese president says a delay in the formation of a new government is due to politicians' increasing demands from Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati. Michel Aoun expressed concerns that the goal of the demands is to force Mikati to resign, which Aoun said he doesn't want. On Tuesday, Mikati described forming a government for Lebanon as a difficult arithmetic equation. He made a comment after a meeting with Aoun at the presidential palace. Lebanon's ruling elite have failed to form a new cabinet since Prime Minister Hassan Diab quit following last year's devastating explosion at Beirut's port. This has further deepened the country's economic crisis. The World Bank has described it as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. Throughout the war in Syria, Takfiri terrorists used a false extreme interpretation of Islam to appear as if they were freedom fighters, and they misled the world that they fight for justice. The reality proved the opposite. They destroyed every place they set foot in. They were mostly holy Muslim sites and mosques. A correspondent has more.
Video was filmed on Ashura Day inside the Sukaina Shrine in Daraya in Damascus countryside before the war in Syria started. Mourners used to peacefully mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. However, the site nowadays is in a totally different situation. Terrorists occupied and used the shrine as a stronghold during the clashes that happened there, gradually causing its destruction.
Terrorists are implementing a global and intelligence plot. They target our symbols and try to destroy them. For example, in Raqqa, they destroyed the shrine of a symbol of Siffin battle, Sayyid Ammar bin Yasser, and in Damascus, Sayyida Sukaina. They want to break the morale of resistance supporters.
Those images are seen by Syrians as an interpretation of what the followers of oppressors and tyrants of our time want for Islam, which are terrorists operating as tools of our time's main oppressor, the United States. In 2016, they left Daraya to Idlib, leaving total destruction behind. But their departure reflected their ultimate defeat. It was resistance by the Syrian army and its allies that led to their victory.
Islamic resistance all around the world raised the flag of righteousness and defeated Takfiri terrorism, Israel and the U.S. The resistance in Lebanon and Syria derived its power from Imam Hussein's revolution in Ashura, which created the philosophy of freedom and liberation.
Sayyida Sukaina is the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the sister of Imam Hussein, who led a historic and peaceful uprising against the tyrant Yazid. He was martyred in 680 AD along with his companions, while his family members were brutally taken as captives from one city to another. Syria is a country that hosts a large number of holy Islamic sites. Takfiri terrorists' Islamic disguise was eventually unveiled, and the truth was revealed that they are just agents of the West. If it wasn't for the resistance movement and fighters who follow the path of Imam Hussein, probably many other sites, like say the Zainab Shrine, would have been destroyed. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Several people are reportedly killed during anti-Taliban rallies and a stampede in the eastern Afghan city of Assadabad. According to witnesses, the militants opened fire on protesters marking the country's Independence Day in the capital of Kunar province. The demonstrators waved Afghan flags and, according to some reports, tore down the white flag of the Taliban. Similar rallies were held in another eastern city, Jalalabad, where at least three protesters were killed on Wednesday. Meantime, gunshots were heard in the capital, Kabul, where people were marking the 102nd anniversary of Afghanistan's independence from British rule. Now, following the recent developments in Afghanistan, Iran has seen a steady influx of Afghan refugees. The border police have set up temporary camps alongside Iran's eastern border with Afghanistan to host the inbound refugees. Yusuf Chalabi has a report.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran.
This is the Iranian-Afghan border. Afghan refugees have just crossed into Iran, a country they call a second home.
Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I asked the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak Crossing Point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 under pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now, with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
Malaysia's former Deputy Prime Minister Ismail Sabri Yaakob has secured a parliamentary majority, moving closer to forming a new government. According to local media, Ismail Sabri has received the backing of 114 of 220 lawmakers. King Al-Sultan Abdullah has summoned the supporting lawmakers to his palace to endorse their candidate. If appointed, Sabri would mark the return of the United Malays National Organization Party to leadership 3 years after losing a general election over corruption allegations. On Monday, Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin stepped down after losing the majority in parliament. A resignation threw the country into a fresh crisis in the midst of a worsening coronavirus outbreak and ailing economy. Iran's COVID-19 restrictions, which began on Monday, will be in place until Saturday. They include a ban on road travel. The lockdown also requires all non-essential businesses and offices to close. Meantime, health officials say the country's COVID deaths have passed the 100,000 mark, with 564 new fatalities recorded on Thursday. There's also a report of over 31,000 new infections, raising the caseload to more than 4.5 million. Iran has been grappling with a fifth wave of the coronavirus, triggered by the highly contagious Delta variant. Authorities have accelerated the vaccination campaign to contain the surge. Australia continues to struggle with the COVID outbreak as it is logging its biggest daily rise in cases. Officials recorded 754 infections on Thursday, with New South Wales state accounting for the bulk, including one death. The figure marks a record rise in cases in the state for a second consecutive day. The Prime Minister of New South Wales now saying that lockdowns will remain in place there until the end of August. Meantime, police have been enforcing lockdowns and assisting in aid distribution across the state capital, Sydney. Restrictions were imposed after a Delta strain-driven outbreak in the city in mid-June. So far, more than 50% of the state's population has received at least one dose of the vaccine. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Ashura, history's most heartrending tragedy. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the anniversary of the most heartrending event the world has ever seen, and which, despite the passing of a millennium, 3 centuries, and 82 years, continues to interact with human conscience in every age and era to guide people and nations towards reforms and the quest for social justice based on dignity. Stay with us for an exclusive feature in this regard. Allah, exalted is your station, great is your power, and stupendous your might. You have no need of the creatures, your supremacy is all-embracing, and you have the power to do whatever you wish. Your mercy is near, your promise is true, your blessings are plenteous, and your tests are beautiful. I call you in the hour of my need and beseech you in the moment of my destitution. I turn to your help in my weakness and put my trust in you as being sufficient for me. Judge between us and our people with justice, for indeed they have dealt with us deceitfully and treacherously, forsaken us and betrayed us and spilled our blood, though we are the progeny of your prophet and the offspring of your beloved Muhammad ibn Abdullah, whom you chose for your apostleship and trusted with your revelation. The passage that you heard are excerpts from the famous supplication recited by Imam Hussein, peace upon him, on the day of his martyrdom in Karbala, in 10th of Muharram, 61 AH, corresponding to 680 AD. Today, in spite of the worldwide spread of the coronavirus pandemic, the faithful continue to commemorate, of course, with due medical precaution and social distancing, history's most blood-curdling tragedy. It is the immortal saga of the grandson of the seal of divine messengers that is commemorated not just in the land where he was treacherously martyred, but all over the world, wherever are found the devout followers of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We use the term devout followers since devotion is the highest degree of love and affection for the Prophet's person and his God-given position, coupled with practical adherence to his way of life and teachings, that is, Sunnah and Sirah. Moreover, without devotion, the mere claim to be a follower could be dubious, as is clear from the words of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in the supplication that he and the other members of the Prophet's family were the victims of the treachery and deceit, not of adherents of other creeds, but of those styling themselves as Muslims. It is an irony of Muslim history that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, as a member of the Immaculate Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless purity God has vouched in the Noble Quran in Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab, and decreed love and affection for them as token of a believer's gratitude to the Prophet for enlightening him or her with the message of Islam, as is evidenced by Ayah 23 of Surah Shura, was slain on the orders of a person claiming to be the political heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Thus, although the day of Ashura and the mourning ceremonies of Muharram and the subsequent month of Safar might be expressions of devotional grief by the faithful and renewal of their allegiance to Imam Hussein, ideals of justice and refusal to bow to tyranny, this annual commemoration definitely raises questions in the minds of conscientious non-Muslim observers. They ask how Yazid and the Umayyad regime clung to the apex of power of the Islamic realm since as late as 8 AH and the fall of Mecca 2 years before the Prophet's departure from the world. Yazid's father Muawiyah and grandfather Abu Sufyan were hardcore heathens, never missing an opportunity to strike at Islam and Muslims. And if it is claimed that Umayyad rule was legitimate and as per the commandments of God in the Noble Quran and the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, then what unpardonable offense had Imam Hussein, peace upon him, committed to deserve such a tragic death along with 18 other male members of the Prophet's family, including his 6-month-old infant son. Both Muslims and non-Muslims owe to ponder on these questions. If the verdict is in favor of the righteousness of the stand of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and against Yazid and his Umayyad hordes, then they should be true to their conscience and probe in a diligently scientific manner as to what went wrong after the passing away of the Prophet, that a tragedy of such a bestial magnitude occurred in Karbala, which did not even spare the women folk and children of the Prophet's household from imprisonment. It is an irony of Islamic history that in 19 AH, corresponding to 640 AD, Muawiyah was given the governorship of the vast province of Sham, made up of today's Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, including the illegal entity called Israel. In the subsequent years, Muawiyah, who is on record as saying that every time the Muazzin recites the Prophet's name in the Azan, he feels intense hatred deep down in his heart, came out in open armed rebellion against Imam Ali, peace upon him. He next intimidated and bribed the Iraqis to betray Imam Hassan, peace upon him, so as to seize the caliphate in 41 AH, corresponding to 661 AD. Then, in violation of the clauses of the treaty with the elder grandson of the Prophet, whom he martyred through a fatal dose of poison in 50 AH or 670 AD, he nominated the libertine Yazid as his successor in 60 AH. These are the bitter realities of Muslim history that climaxed at Karbala in 61 AH, corresponding to 680 AD, where only the sacrifice on such a grand scale by the Prophet's younger grandson could salvage Islam. It ripped off the mask of hypocrisy from the face of Yazid for the tyrant and seeing the head of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in a tray before him, burst out saying that he had avenged his heathen ancestors killed in the battles of Badr and Uhud, which his grandfather Abu Sufyan had imposed on the Prophet and Muslims. It should now be clear that the killers of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, were not Jews, not Christians, not Hindus, not Zoroastrians, not Buddhists, not shamanists, not pagans, and not atheists, but people who called themselves Muslims and knew him very well with full knowledge that he was a paragon of virtue. Most of them had heard, either directly or indirectly from their elders, the Prophet's immortal phrase, "An al-Husayn misbahul huda wa safinatun najat," whose English rendering is, "Indeed, Hussein is the beacon of guidance and the ark of salvation." For the true believers, this wasn't the dotting of a middle-aged grandfather, especially when God says that his prophet neither adds nor speaks out of desire, and it is nothing but revelation revealed, as the Noble Quran says in ayahs 2-4 of Surah Najm. Perhaps some of the Prophet's companions who before becoming Muslims had spent the greater part of their life worshipping idols and indulging in all sorts of cardinal sins might not have properly gauged the words of the seal of divine messengers regarding his grandson or the rest of his immaculate Ahlul Bayt, whose spotless purity the noble Quran vouches. If they had, Islamic history would have been spared of the greatest ever discord as a result of their violation of divine commandments. If they had, 50 years after the Prophet's departure, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, would not have been so tragically martyred. Now we understand why the Prophet used to say in such explicit words, Hussein minni wa ana min al Hussein. Hussein is from me and I am from Hussein. We also begin to comprehend his other immortal phrase regarding his two grandsons, Al Hassan wal Hussein, Sayyidai Shabab wa Ahlul Jannah. Hassan and Hussein are the leaders of the youth of paradise. Thus, it becomes obvious to us what Imam Hussein, peace upon him, means and to whom he refers in his supplication to God, cited at the start of the program, when he speaks of the treachery, deceit, and betrayal of the Ahlul Bayt. Ashura and the Ziyarat. We recite on this day, have drawn the clearest line between the truth and falsehood for the guidance of human societies. For on this day, blood triumphed over naked swords to jolt human conscience and present to mankind the most endurable barometer for ascertaining one's faith. The day of Ashura thus freshens up our memories every year of the heroic stand of the Prophet's grandson who refused to give his hand in allegiance to a tyrant by preferring the glory of martyrdom to an abject life under an oppressive and corrupt system. Here is a passage from the famous Ziyarat, or salutation to Imam Hussein, peace upon him, on this day. O Abu Abdullah, your martyrdom was a great calamity and the cause of great distress for us and all followers of Islam. It was a tremendous calamity that befell the heavens and which affected all the denizens of the heavens. May Allah's curse be on those who instituted a regime of wrongdoing and injustice against you, Ahlul Bayt. May Allah's curse be on those who sideline you from your rightful station and whittle from you the status that Allah had assigned you. May Allah's curse be on those who slew you, and may His curse be on those who paved the way for them, making it possible to wage war against you. Before God and you, I repudiate them, their supporters, their followers, and those who befriend them. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing 69 Minutes of 86 Days, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Egil Hoshel Larsen. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morningstar newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist in both television and radio for many years. And beside her is Zita Holborn, who is the co-founder and national chair of Barack UK and has been coordinating solidarity, aid and fact-finding missions in support of refugees in France for over 2 years. Now, 69 Minutes of 86 Days is a documentary about the hardships of being a refugee as seen through a child's eyes. With minimal dialogue, the director takes us into the journey of 3-year-old Syrian child Leanne and shows her family trekking through Europe with the goal of reuniting with her grandfather to settle in Sweden. First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a magnificent documentary, extremely moving, and it's the kind of documentary that stays with you for days, especially because it was told from a child's perspective. Now, Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your impression of this documentary?
Well, it does stay with you, and I found that it was one of the most unique documentaries on the refugee crisis that I've seen, and actually quite an impressive directorial debut by Larsen himself. He was a cameraman, he was a cinematographer, and you can tell that in the way that it's shot. And what's interesting is that he shot it from her perspective and her height. So the camera moves with her. And it's very intriguing and inspiring use of putting this story across. And it's quite a humanizing way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is well, adorable. And the fact is that there are no voiceovers, there's no narration, you have no idea what's going on, very much like the little girl herself, Leanne. She has no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, at 3, you go where you're taken. And for her, in many ways, it was kind of like a game, although at times the camera kind of stays on her and she looks really, really serious.
I wanted to ask you actually a bit more about that point, about the style of the filmmaking, because the Larsen does use low-angle steadicam shots mixed with long takes, as you were saying. And do you think that the director, Larsen, was successful in trying to transfer the child's experience to the viewer in this way?
Well, I think so, because you can see her energy and her hope and her childlike wonderment. When the film opens, it's a tracking shot of the beach, and you see all these things strewn on it. You have no idea what's coming or where it's going, and then it kind of tracks up. You see all these refugees queuing up. They're being given flip-flops, they've been given food, and then it hones in on her and her look and what's going through her little mind. We have no idea. You know, it's a child's world. But to her, you know, it's all games as well. But she knows that she's being taken from her home to Sweden. And that's how we learn about it, because at no point are you told where they are, where they're going, really, apart from a song that she sings where she says, oh, we're going to Sweden in Germany to live with Grandpa, you know.
That was a really endearing moment.
Yeah,
I think it was there to help keep her going through that journey. And Zita, I want to bring you in here. What was your impression of the film? Do you agree with Maria's take?
I agree with quite a bit of what Maria has said. I think it was quite endearing to show it through the eyes of a child in the way it was shot. It was a unique perspective that we don't normally see or hear. Usually the times we hear about children are in a very technical way, as you know, unaccompanied minors or when they tragically died. So it was positive to see it from the perspective of a child. But I also think that in some places
you know, the narrative was missing. But you have to look at what the purpose of the film was, and was it to do what lots of other people have done before, or was it to do something different and to show this perspective on it?
No, I agree with you, actually, and I want to explore those details a bit later on in terms of how powerful that impact had by having minimal dialogue. She's such a cute, gorgeous little girl, Leanne, and as a viewer, I feel like you feel the need to protect her in that hostile world that she's in. And Maria, you were touching upon this a bit earlier on. What are some of the hardships that we witness Leanne and her family encounter on their journey?
Well, there's an interesting shot of them all being sort of held against a barrier and the police kind of treating these refugees as cattle, really. And you kind of think, that this isn't on, you know, this isn't right. But I don't think that's what the film wants to show you. I think it wants to show you the fact that they don't know what's happening. She doesn't know what's happening. It's crazy. It's frightening in many ways. And it's disorientating. So hence why there's no narration. You have no idea where they are at any given time, what country they're in.
Do you think this is a metaphor in general, sorry, as the viewers, that we sympathise with Leanne because it's a metaphor for the Western audience's general ignorance of the issue, perhaps, that we don't know where they are, what's happening?
Well, exactly, yes, in some ways. And also that she's an ordinary little girl. She's got a backpack from the film Frozen. You know, this could be any of us at any given time. And basically to... you know, come to terms, sort of empathise with her situation. The thing is, we've seen films where you see children being, you know, treated horrifically, and so this is a different way of getting the message across, and poignantly, and with this three-year-old girl, and she is very, I mean, she's gorgeous to look at, and very sweet, and very cute, and very funny. There's a scene where she's playing with her sister, and she's, you know, giving her a lollipop, and the whole thing is that the family are trying to keep it as normal as possible, but it isn't a normal situation.
And Zita, from your experience working with refugees and refugee children, what kind of conditions are they enduring and kind of problems that they have on journey?
Well, they're going through horrific conditions and experiences. What we didn't see in the film for Leanne is some of the experiences that refugee children that I've met and worked with, where you know, they're having to cross deserts, where they're having to go on very small boats in perilous conditions across the Mediterranean Sea, and effectively, you know, the families are risking their lives to get them to a safe place. They're staying in very harsh conditions, where at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Calais, with both of the camps destroyed, people don't have tents. They're staying outside. The police have been stealing their blankets and their sleeping bags if they get them, and stripping those away from them. They were over the last few months, they've had a one-hour slot in which they can access a tank of water to have a wash in front of hundreds of people. So actually, the conditions are stark. When there wasn't an infrastructure in Dunkirk, and particularly in Calais, there was a school and an art school, and so there was some system in place for children to have, you know, snippets of normality.
So would you say that Leanne is one of the lucky ones that got away?
If you look at her journey in the film, for the bits that we see of it, seems to be quite a positive journey compared to some of the refugee children I've met. I'm not saying it's completely positive, because obviously long journey like that, there are risks all the way. It's tiring. You're staying in tents and camps and so on, so it's not easy. But I also think, I don't quite agree with you in terms of Leanne's naivety. I think actually she's very intelligent and very articulate. And if you listen to the little things she says and the little songs she sings, you can see actually she is reflecting on her conditions, particularly on the coach when she talks about what happened to the cat.
Yeah? Yes, I thought that was more really engaging. I wish I saw more of those scenes. So as we were saying, we do enjoy watching these tender, sweet moments with Leanne and these precious moments. I think they give us a sense of relief from the harsh reality of a refugee's life. Maria, the director, Larsen, said at the Copenhagen Film Festival earlier this year that in this film he didn't want to focus so much on the political aspect of the refugee crisis. He wanted to focus more on a child's perspective and sort of it gives some hope, I suppose, to their situation. Do you think that the film should have been more political, though?
That's an interesting question. The thing is, if it had been more political, then it would have been like every other documentary that we've seen on the refugee crisis. He was trying to get his point of view across by Leanne, and he succeeded that to a certain extent. The thing is that it is a snapshot of what they went through. We don't know what the rest of it was like. You know, anyone who has a three-year-old, to keep them entertained for 86 days, I'm sorry, but it would be a nightmare, you know. The thing is, we need to be hopeful, but we need to change people's attitudes, and people are now kind of entrenched about the Syrian refugee crisis, sadly, and this is a different way of putting it across. To engage people in that discussion and to look at it. It is, you know, we're like voyeurs in this film, and what we see is what he's allowing us to see. So the rest may have not been as touching or, you know, as moving or as sweet as the scenes that we saw. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, as I said, keeping a three-year-old entertained or protected from what's going on is really difficult. Their attention span is very short.
And I think Larson used the child, though, on purpose in the sense that she's untainted by the world and she's an innocent, pure soul. So she doesn't know the differences with the cultural and political conflicts.
No.
So in a sense, it gives you a sort of humanistic approach, I think, indeed, to the refugee crisis.
And you need to put a face on it. That's the thing. You've got to humanise people. You know, you can't just say, you know, bunch of Syrian refugees as a whole. These are people just like you and like us going through terrible ordeal. You know, to have to move from, you know, your country to somewhere completely foreign. My parents did it, you know, in the 60s. And my mother kind of never got over it, really, because it was a completely different culture coming to Britain. Circumstances, they're not comparable. But what I'm saying is if you have to leave your home, and in their case, they're forced to leave their home to go somewhere else, and people are not giving them the respect that they kind of deserve, or the kindness, you see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean, it's a really good point.
It's, you know, we're supposed to, you know, care for everyone, we're supposed to care for each other, and we've become, you know, in the world now where it's every man and woman for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, I just wanted to read a statistic here about refugees. So according to the UN Refugee Agency, 86% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. So the countries hosting the most refugees are Turkey, home to 2.5 million, Pakistan, 1.6 million, Lebanon, 1.1 million, and Iran, around 1 million. Now, what do you think of the Western world's efforts in sheltering and accommodating the refugees? Do you think they could be doing a better job?
They could definitely be doing far more than they're doing. Actually, the UK record is woeful. You know, for 2 years I've been working with people who are refugees in France who are stuck in limbo, effectively, trying to get to the UK. Many of them are children. The average age currently of the people that are there, if you want to call them adults, is around age 17 or 18. So this is very young people that have left home when they were children, have struggled and travelled alone, may have lost all their family members, have had to form bonds and family, to travel across Europe to try and get to a safe place, and are being separated from their families and connections here in the UK. And then all the scapegoating and demonising of migrants, and trying to blame the cuts and austerity impact that we're experiencing here on migrants is an absolute disgrace. We've had the Immigration Act introduced in the UK, which is like seeks to create an apartheid-like state. And then even when people are here, we're seeing mass deportations to countries like Jamaica, Nigeria, and Pakistan. So yes, the UK and other European Western countries could do far more. They're not demonstrating humanity. And actually, I think that's what we saw in the film. We saw humanity. We saw the reality of a family trying to shield and protect their children. And you could see the sadness and pain and fear in the eyes of the adults, but they tried to protect the children from that and, you know, keep things positive so that the children, and particularly Leanne, could have hope for a better future.
Thank you for that point. It was a really good point. I want to touch more on what you were saying about the anti-refugee sentiment across Europe. Now, we're in the final part of the discussion of this programme now, and I just want to talk a little bit about how in the documentary there isn't no specific reference to the country of origin of the refugees. Do you think Larson did this in an attempt to perhaps internationalise the refugee issue?
Maybe, but also to keep you disorientated in a way, like they were. We assume that they started off from a Greek port and then they go through, I think they went through Hungary and Austria and then Germany and then on to Sweden. But you have no idea where they're going or what's the passage of time, actually. You know, and only by the signposts and people speaking in German do you realise they're in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that's basically to keep it, you know, to keep you on your toes and to give you the experience or part of the experience that they went through, because Leanne had no idea where she was going.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, would you agree with Marie's take?
Not necessarily. I can't speculate on why it was done like that and why it wasn't mentioned. You know, within a few minutes, I'd figured out that's where they were from anyway, because I can hear them speaking and, you know, I can look at them and guess where they're from. But actually, I think the important part of the film wasn't about, he wasn't trying to tell their backstory and what they were fleeing from. There was no focus on that. It was about the journey you go on as a refugee. So all people who are refugees are going through those same trials and tribulations and challenges, and, you know, it's tiring, it's long, it's challenging. So I think that the focus was on, this is what you're going through. Here is a family who are a tight family, who are supporting each other, looking after each other. They're a loving family. You know, they're embracing their children. They're sticking together. And this is what you have to do to get through a perilous and long and difficult journey, which is not just physically difficult, but actually mentally and spiritually.
And psychologically, yeah. Definitely. But I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people would argue that, in fact, refugees getting to their destination in Europe is actually not the hardest part, given the rise of the increase in anti-refugee, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, with far-right groups, for example. Do you think it's likely that children such as Leanne will face a lot of racism and abuse once they settle in the countries?
Absolutely. Actually, I sat, you know, as the credits came up at the end of the film, thinking, okay, this is all very fairy tale, happily ever after. This is not the reality of what people go through as refugees, or even migrating, you know, where my family came and migrated to the UK. She will face discrimination. And often young people that I meet who are refugees in France, they ask, what's it like in the UK? It's better there, and it's going to be better for us, and it's going to be better equality. And I'm truthful to them. I tell them what I do as an activist, that actually my entire life has been dedicated to campaigning against racism and prejudice and xenophobia, because we're still facing those challenges. So it won't be easy for her. It's going to be challenging.
So we'd really like to see a follow-up documentary to see how Leanne's life would play out.
It would be interesting, but again, if he's going to go for this style of documentary, then, you know, it's cinematic, basically. But I suspect as a three-year-old, I mean, I was 10 months old when I came to Britain, you get used to your surroundings and, you know, you become part of society and you forget what...
You integrate.
And she's three, and she will presumably integrate. But yeah, it's
perhaps many challenges lie ahead. And
indeed,
we'll just have to,
and it's scary times at the moment, and also post Brexit, I have to say. So
it's scary times indeed, and I'm afraid we'll have to end it there. But thank you very much. I enjoyed this discussion of the documentary, and that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.